This is Shutters Inc. with Bruce Williams.
Hi, and welcome to episode 417 of Shutters Inc. This is Bruce Williams from ShuttersIncPodcast.com, and joining me from Allentown, Pennsylvania, it is none other than Mr. Joe Edelman. Joe, welcome back to Shutters Inc.
Hello, Bruce. It's glad to be back. I didn't think you guys would let me come back, so it's really good to know that I'm still welcome and I'm ready to roll because your partner's not there, so you know we can have some fun tonight.
Mate, you are always welcome here. Absolutely. How have you been? It must have been over 12 months since we had you on the podcast.
It has been over 12 months. Yeah, it's been a long time. I've been good. I've been busy. I guess the big news for me is I officially said to hell with Nikon. Gave up on them, switched over to Olympus, met a bunch of people at Olympus. They decided that I was just the right fit for them, and I became an Olympus visionary.
Wow.
And that is really cool, but I did something really stupid, Bruce.
Oh.
When I got the contract, I was really excited. I mean, really excited. And, you know, it was all the stuff about brand ambassador and that. But, yep. Like, when you're in a hurry and you're a little type A like I am and sometimes a little ADHD, I thought it said brand the ambassador. And I already have a couple tattoos. So I went out and I got this big, huge Olympus logo tattooed on my arm. And then when I sat down and read the contract again, I realized it was brand ambassador. So not only am I an Olympus visionary, but I have the tattoo to prove it.
You
so
have
now,
a
of course,
walking
I'm,
billboard.
I'm trying to bully the other visionaries around the world, including yours down there in Australia, say, hey, come on, guys, like tattoos. Let's show that pride. Because I don't want to be the only one dumb enough to read the contract wrong.
So I'm interested to ask, and feel free to say no comment if you don't want to go down that rabbit hole. What was it about Nikon that made you decide it was time to jump ship?
No, that's definitely not a rabbit hole. In fact, I've done a couple videos about it. I talk about it a lot. So first things first, let me start with this, especially now that I'm, you know, kind of the owned Olympus guy. I want to be really clear about something. I speak about this a lot. I have no ill will towards Nikon, Canon. I want to see those two companies survive and succeed. I think it is extremely important for the photography industry that both of those companies remain successful.
Yes.
For me, I was for years... and when I say years, probably 4 or 5 years, very interested and really just salivating at the idea of being able to go mirrorless. I had switched very briefly to Sony back right about the time that the A7R was the camera that I had. And I also had a Sony A6000, which both of them, great cameras, don't get me wrong. But these were my issues. They really just, at that point in time, Sony was not ready for prime time, showing all the promise in the world, but they had very few lenses.
Yeah,
and I'll admit, I'm old school. You know, unfortunately, I date back to the dark ages when zoom lenses really, really, really sucked, and there was no such thing as autofocus. Like, it was just unheard of. So that's how long I've been around, right?
Yeah.
So, but as a result of that, I also remember the days when only idiots bought third-party lenses like, you know, Sigma and Tamron. So obviously, even those companies come a long way today.
Yeah, totally.
So I'm not comfortable with adapters. So let me just put that out there straight up.
Yep.
And I know a lot of people love them. They, you know, and I know we have really good adapters available. I get it, but I'm just not comfortable with adapters. So,
but back in that day, around your 6000 and your 7R, those adapters were really, they were a sacrifice in AF speed.
Yes, they were. They absolutely were. And I wasn't in love with the ergonomics. And ergonomics is a big thing for me. You know, I'm one of those people that was crazy enough to stick with Nikon in the early 2000s when Canon was pretty much just mopping the floor with Nikon because I just never liked the Canon ergonomics. So, you know, it was a short-lived romance with Sony, showed a lot of promise. So I went back and I just remained a very frustrated Nikon user waiting for the day. And, of course, Panasonic came along. So really the fact that I'm an Olympus user is actually Panasonic's fault. So Panasonic's came along with, you know, the video, and I was using the GH4 for video, and literally, true story, the day the GH5 came, I just needed a break. And so it showed up late morning, and I opened it up, put the battery in it, and it had power. So I was like, you know what? I'm going to take the afternoon off and go to a park. Everybody says these cameras are actually good with stills, and I'm thinking that's a stupid idea because the sensor's so damn small. And I went out, and I shot with it for an afternoon. And it was really impressive, okay? It was really impressive. And this was a GH5, right? So that, it kind of got me thinking. It's like, you know, and I still wasn't a big fan of the ergonomics of the GH5. The Panasonics, for my taste, they're boxy. Okay. Now, when you're shooting video with them, you don't care about any of that. You've got it on a tripod or you've got it in a cage, right? So you're not actually handling the camera. Mm-hmm. But for stills, it was boxy. It's a bizarrely deep camera from front to back. So I started doing some research just out of curiosity because just like I had tried out the Sony, I really wanted mirror. I mean, you know, once you use an EVF, it's hard to go back to an optical viewfinder. It just is.
Wow.
So plus, you know, size, weight, everything else. So I started doing some research, you know, good old Google and all the photo blogs. And I kept, you know, it kept coming back to the idea that, well, if you're looking at Micro Four Thirds and if you're looking at stills, you got to look at Olympus. And so there was this kind of dividing line. It's like, yeah, both companies are good, but Panasonic's the video company. And let's face it, Panasonic cameras are video centric. And that's not an insult. That's, you know, that's a great thing that they've done. So I rented an Olympus, an EM1 Mark II, and played around with it for a weekend. Loved it, but I was really stupid about the rental because I really wasn't organized. So, you know, I wound up shipping it back. And it's like, okay, well, that was really cool, but I still don't know if I could change because I had like 50 million unanswered questions. So I rented a second one and was a lot more organized. And then true story, actually a year ago, almost this week, I was in New York City at Photo Plus, where I'm going to be next week.
Yeah.
And I met Gavin Hoey from Great Britain.
Okay, yep.
And it was kind of a very, very humbling and very surreal experience. I was in the hall early on the Saturday morning before the show opened. And suddenly I hear this British guy yelling my name, like down the aisle. And I turn around and Gavin Hoey is running down the aisle. I'm like, what is this? Like, how does he even know who I am? Turns out he listens to my talk chat while he's editing. That's his entertainment while he edits. He listens to my talk chat. So, you know, I just like, hey, you're an Olympus user, right? And he's like, yeah. And so we talked for about an hour and he actually introduced me to some of the marketing people at Olympus. And they were like, hey, if you're interested, you can try out a system. So they like were kind enough to loan me a system.
Nice.
And they gave me 2 months to use it.
Oh.
And I had it for 2 weeks. And I called them back. It, you know, it was their PR department. And I called them back and I said, hey, I want to bring it back. Because here's the other irony. I live 12 minutes from the U.S. headquarters of Olympus.
Oh, seriously?
And I have lived 12 minutes from their headquarters for like the last 18 years, okay?
Wow.
So I'm at least familiar with where they're at, but you know, I've just never paid any attention to their cameras because small sensors isn't bigger, better, right? That was, you know, the whole theory. And I called back after 2 weeks and she's like, oh, you know, you're not interested. And I'm like, no. I've made my mind up. I already ordered mine. Like I had already ordered my system and so the funny part is, you know, still to this day, and so that actually became my relationship, you know, at that point, because once I got on board, you know, they asked if I'd be interested in doing some speaking, and one thing led to another. But still to this day, I show up to do talks, and it's the same thing, it's hysterical. I have so much fun with it, because people will, like, they'll lean over, you know, like, just hush-hush, with a hand over the mouth. It's like, did you really sell all your Nikon gear? You know, like I still have it stuck in a closet somewhere just in case, you know, and it's like, no, look, I have the PayPal items, you know, to prove it. It's gone. Or not PayPal, the eBay. I mean, so no, I did get rid of it all. And, you know, what it honestly became for me, it became a couple of things. One, I love the system. Truly, truly love the system. Two, given the teaching that I do, I mean, with YouTube and you guys know that I'm kind of the anti-gear guy. It's like, look, let's learn photography and make good pictures. So it's really become a way actually for me to reinforce my messaging. Say, look, you know, you can go ahead and get your full frame cameras and that's not bad, but don't have this mentality that you have to have a full frame camera to take decent pictures.
Yeah.
Unless you want to look me in the face and tell me my photography sucks. In which case, okay, then maybe we have a point, right? But
well, that actually brings up an interesting point, Joe, that I wanted to come back to, because you mentioned just a moment ago about Olympus with their smaller sensors. They're Micro Four Thirds, which means they're just marginally smaller than an APS-C sensor. Is that correct?
Correct.
Yep. Now, as sensor gets smaller, shallow depth of field becomes harder to achieve. And you, like my regular co-host Glyn, you guys are both like mad people shooters. That is primarily what you shoot and what you are known for shooting. So the naturally inquisitive part of me says, how does a person who loves to shoot people primarily deal with having a smaller sensor and finding that shallow depth of field thing harder to achieve?
Right.
So
So the naturally inquisitive part of you just wants me to go ahead and really anger like half of the photography community. So, so here's the answer.
Yeah.
So there's a couple sides to my response. And I talk about this a lot because I get the question a lot. So number one, you know, the first thing is to understand that there are four ways. There are only three that are traditionally taught in textbooks.
Okay.
But there are four ways to control depth of field. Okay. So, you know, sensor size, it has an impact. Sensor size doesn't actually, so let's be clear. Sensor size doesn't actually have any impact on depth of field, as does the lens not actually impact your depth of field, mm-hmm. okay? If we want to get deep into the mud of the science, which we won't for the sake of simple conversation. The simple fact of the matter is, though, you're right. In actual practice, if we just keep it relative, yes, it is a little bit harder to get that super shallow depth of field. But we got to remember, you can accomplish shallow depth of field not only with your aperture, but also with your focal length, with your focal distance, you know, subject from the camera to the subject. And also, the fourth one that people don't talk about in terms of the controls, remember that there is more than one rule of thirds in photography. So when you are looking at your depth of field, one third of the depth of field is in front of your focal point, and two thirds is behind your focal point, regardless of the focal distance.
Yes.
But what that means is that you can manipulate your depth of field to a degree by choosing to focus on a different point in your scene, even with a person. Okay. You know, that's not one you're going to use a lot with people, but still an option. A good example would be like you've got a group of people that's like six rows deep. Which row do you focus on? Right. Yeah. Get everybody in focus to maximize your depth of field, that kind of a thing. So that's on the practical side. There's more than one way to skin the cat. It's just like, you know, everybody thinks they have to buy a high-speed sync flash to take pictures outside in bright sunlight. And my response is, how the hell did we ever do that in the 1970s? Because we did that shit all the time, but yet we didn't have high-speed sync then. It's like, high-speed sync's cool, but it's a convenience feature, right? So if you really want to be good with high-speed sync, you're actually going to go learn how to do it without high-speed sync. And then you realize how the high-speed sync is actually helping you.
Yep.
But that's not why people buy high-speed sync. And this brings me back to the shallow depth of field question that you asked. People buy the damn high-speed sync because some bozo on YouTube does it all the time and they think they have to do it. And that's why everybody wants the, you know, creamy bokeh. Because, and my question to that is, at what point in the world of portrait photography did the background become more important than the subject? People fight and argue and debate over how to get the right background creaminess. And in the meantime, they're taking pictures of people with hair all over their face and crappy expressions and horrible body language, crappy lighting, ridiculous shadows. But damn, that background is creamy smooth, right? So, like, I don't know, somewhere the priorities changed. And, you know, I'm just an old guy, so what the hell do I know? It's like, I was taught that you pay attention to your subject, you know. So yeah. But, hey, it is. I mean, people tend to follow trends and they get hung up on it. And but I can swear to you, honestly, I've had, and now, the people that follow me closely, especially the detractors, will turn around and say, well, he shoots mostly in the studio. Well, yeah, in the studio it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. But actually, even on location, not that big a deal. I mean, I just actually posted a video yesterday, a project that I did for Olympus using their little Pen EPL9 camera.
Right.
I did the whole assignment. It was on location in Brooklyn, New York, and did the whole assignment with the 12-100, which for full frame people, that's a 24-200 millimeter equivalent zoom. And this little, essentially, it's kind of like a super powered point and shoot camera, the Pen EPL9. I had no problem getting really, really awesome, soft backgrounds. And now, in all fairness, too, these were scenarios where we wanted to be able to tell that that was the Brooklyn Bridge,
yep.
but not have the Brooklyn Bridge in focus. We wanted it blurry. We wanted it nice and creamy. But yeah, I mean, it's all about
but still have enough detail to make it obvious as to what it was. Yeah,
right. To get a hint that, you know, it's New York in the background. Exactly. Nice. Right. So we shot in this little section of New York called Dumbo, which is like right across the river from Lower Manhattan. So basically all your backgrounds are, you know, the World Trade Center and Brooklyn Bridge and that kind of stuff. So you kind of want that flavor to it, but indeed you don't want so much detail that you lose your subject in it. I had no problem at all.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't the World Trade Center not there anymore?
Well, there's a new one.
Oh, Okay.
Truly. No,
forgive me. I have not been to New York, so I don't know what they erected in its place.
Yeah, no,
so.
That's okay. We do, and it is referred to as the World Trade Center.
It's cool.
I think its address is called One World Trade Center.
Oh, okay.
So what they did, the short version, is where the two towers used to be,
yeah.
It's actually a really, really impressive thing to see. They took the foundation section, so that basically two squares,
right,
and they turned them into these massive fountains.
Oh, okay. As in water fountains?
Right. Yep.
Yeah.
The actual size of the footprint of the two original buildings and the names of those who perished are engraved into it. Kind of like the Vietnam War Memorial has awesome. The names engraved, you know, in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
So they did that same thing. And then right next to them, they built two new buildings. One is the new World Trade Center, which is an incredibly tall building that it kind of honors some of the architecture of the real ones, but it's still very, very different.
Yeah,
and they also built this amazing building, which if you've never seen it, Google it. It's ironically, it's a shopping mall and a train station. So if we break it down to what it really is, it's a shopping mall and a train station, but it's called the Oculus.
Right.
And it's, I'm not even going to try to describe it. Just Google it and look at the pictures. It's imagine that somebody took a bird and stripped it down to its bones.
Okay.
Which sounds really bizarre. But that's kind of what this building looks like, both inside and out. It's amazing. It's an architectural wonder.
Wow.
Probably one of the most photographed buildings in the United States at this point.
Oh,
everybody
okay.
wants to take pictures there.
I shall have to Google that.
It's really cool. So, yeah, so there is a World Trade Center now.
Nice.
And it's called One World Trade Center. And it is so, and it, of course, dominates the Manhattan skyline. So, yeah.
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah. Cool. Sorry, how did we get onto that?
I'm not sure. I think it has something to do with how great Olympus is, but that's okay.
fantastic. Fantastic. Shall we look at some user-submitted stories?
Sure. Go for it.
Okay. So the first thing that I wanted to address was something that I came across this week. As listeners to this podcast know, I'm a Sony shooter because I came from Minolta in the film days. And I've been shooting with an A850 for 10 years. Sorry, what was that, Joe?
Okay. No, I was just being a smartass. I said my sympathies.
You
were a Minolta
guy. You didn't like Minolta.
Well, no, back in the film days, I was a nighttime guy, and that was definitely something to be proud of back then. So, yeah.
Well, you see, but, my very
No, seriously,
first...
Minolta made good stuff. Even back in the days, and I think, didn't maybe this company merge with Minolta?
So what happened?
Company that was a Highlander rate.
It was Konica merged with Minolta later on.
That's who it was, right? Yeah, because right. Konica made some really nice cameras back in the day too.
Right. So what happened was my first film SLR was the Dynax 7000, or the in America it would have been called the Maxim 7000.
Mm-hmm.
That would have been circa 1990, 1991, thereabouts.
Yep.
And then what happened was later on, maybe early 2000, late 90s, early 2000s, Minolta was struggling. Konica had basically got rid of the majority of their photographic division and were focusing primarily on their medical imaging and their photocopiers.
Right.
And they were struggling as a company. And so the pair of them merged into Konica Minolta and basically had all three product lines. And then what you had was Sony around about, I'm going to say 2006-ish, had a very strong point-and-shoot market, but they had no DSLR technology at all.
Right.
And they wanted to get into that market because they wanted to shake up Canon and Nikon, who they felt were being a little bit lax. And so they went to Konica Minolta and said, we'd like to buy all your DSLR IP. And Konica Minolta said, here, it's all yours. And so that's what happened. And so because I already had a suite of lenses for my Minolta gear, it made sense to stay with Sony because I could then use, you know, my A-mount lenses with a Sony body. So I've been shooting with this A850 for 10 years now. And I saw something on Facebook through the week and it mentioned number of shutter actuations. And I thought, that's really interesting. I have no idea how many shutter actuations I would be up to on my camera. And so I went looking, and it turns out that, and I'll post this really detailed scientific text in the show notes of this episode for anyone that wants to go down that rabbit hole, but I found that what exists within the EXIF metadata that Sony digital SLR cameras produce a couple of little random bits of data, which you take the values of and you multiply them by other numbers, and then you add them all together and you come up with a number which represents the number of shutter actuations that have occurred on the body at the time that image was shot. And someone then took that, there's a piece of open source software called EXIF Tool, and somebody took the source code for that and embedded it into a live web page, so that if you are a Sony shooter, you can drag a raw file from a Sony camera onto this web page. It doesn't upload your image. All it does is read the EXIF metadata from your image through the web page and outputs the number of shutter actuations that had occurred on the body that took that image at the time that that image was taken. And so I'm going to post the link to that in the show notes. So for anyone that shoots Sony, and I know that is a small segment of, of our listenership, anyone that wants to check that out, please knock yourselves out.
Bruce, I think that you may have inadvertently cracked the code to Sony's success. Because I don't know how it is down under for you guys, but here in the U.S., and I say this with respect, I have to give Sony a ton of credit. Right. I mean, they're putting out good cameras, but they have also managed to create this kind of a fanboy mentality, similar to what Apple does. You know, new camera, everybody's got to buy it.
Yeah.
So I think you've cracked the code, because they made it so hard, clearly, to figure out how many times has the shutter been actuated. Because if you try to sell a camera on eBay, that's the first question everybody asks.
Yep.
They've made it so hard to figure that out. Sony users are just like, oh, the hell with it. Just go buy the new one. I think you've cracked the code. There it is.
It is very interesting. So, and I was pleasantly, well, I would say pleasantly surprised. Glyn would just say, you know, I don't shoot enough. To find that over 10 years, I've only shot about 36,000 actuations of my shutter.
Oh, yeah, I would have to agree with him. That's a low number for 10 years. Oh, my gosh, yes. So I've probably got that on my EM1 Mark II that is just under a year old. So, yeah.
Wow.
So, yeah, you definitely need to pick that camera up more, Bruce.
Yeah, I do. What was interesting, I did see a guy post an image on one of the groups on Facebook that I'm in, and he listed his shutter actuation, and he was up to 178,000 actuations, which I thought, wow, that's really pushing the life of the shutter. Because generally they say around about 100,000 for a shutter.
I mean, everybody's kind of got their recommended number. I do think that they tend to kind of undervalue the shutters, you know, as long as you're taking care of the camera. But yeah, that's a very impressive number.
Yeah. Next up, we got an email from Carl. Carl is a regular. That's why I don't mention his surname, Joe. Carl said, hey, guys, here are some creative ways to show off your gear hoarding. And this link has photographs from a bunch of different photographers showing all of their kit laid out in one image. And some of these are really well done. Like, they are creative works of art in their own right.
Oh, indeed.
I was flicking through some of these just before we started to record, and I was thinking to myself, I've seen some of Joe's videos. I'm thinking for Joe to pull off a shot like this is going to require a warehouse without a roof and a helicopter with the doors off.
So here in the U.S., they actually, I don't know if they call them the same thing down where you're at, but they, especially in the social media marketing world, there is a name for these kind of pictures. They're called lay flats.
Oh, okay.
You lay everything flat. So that's the slang marketing term for these. It's a safe bet I will never do one of these simply because I don't have the patience. That's the easy answer. I do not have. I mean, these are cool. The problem with these is I look at these and it's like, ooh, what is that? Oh, I need to go Google that. Oh, damn, just cost me money. So, yeah, no, I try to avoid looking at these pictures. They are quite creative, and as I'm scrolling down the page, I've already seen a couple of things where it's like, no, don't look. I will be in big trouble. So, because, yeah, it's like, wow, there's some cool gadgets here. Interesting, you know, but yeah, they're a big trend. You see a lot of them here in the States, you know, people are doing it. In fact, even actually Olympus just internally, corporately, they just had a contest amongst all their employees to do lay flats with Olympus cameras and that. And then some of the winners, they're actually using their images in marketing.
Oh, nice.
So, yeah, so it's the whole lay flat craze is a a big deal.
I thought it was very cool, and I thought there were some very creative executions amongst them. So thank you, Carl, for the link.
Definitely some neat stuff here.
Definitely. Rob Coates sent us an email, said, "G'day, Inks. Saw this on the ABC news page." This was a link to abc.net.au, and it's all about Steve Irwin's son, Robert, recognized at photo competition for snap of spider devouring frog. Yeah, mm-hmm. So great stuff to see that Bob has, taken up photography. And I mean, we've spoken about Bob's photography in the past because he's been recognized before mm-hmm. this, but it's great to see that he's
even done a few television appearances here in the States. And yep. Kids like this, and I say this with respect, I hate them just a little bit. This kid is amazingly talented. Like, he really is. Like, yep. I'm jealous. I'm yep. truly jealous. Like, and obviously, you know, one of the great things about, you know, being the son of Steve Irwin, he's got this incredible access to this wildlife and also, yep. you know, a knowledge base that goes with it, which is amazing.
Exactly.
So I think we'll see lots of cool stuff from this kid.
And the thing is, he's a good-looking kid, and he's mm-hmm. got the passion that his dad had, which is great.
Yes.
And I think he's just going to continue on the work that Steve was doing, which is fantastic.
Yeah.
So, nice work, Bob.
Definitely, he's got some brilliant photographs.
Yeah, and thanks, Rob, for the link. Adam, who's another regular Joe, he sent us a few stories. The first one, I saw this myself before Adam posted it on the Facebook wall of the Shutters Inc. group and just had a chuckle. Mm-hmm. This is why you don't hire a 25-cent photo retoucher. And the story appears on Petapixel, but it links to a YouTube video of this girl who, she's a photographer. She was just a little overwhelmed.
Irene. Yep. Hey? That's my friend Irene. I know her.
Oh, you know her?
She's a fellow YouTuber. She's actually from Canada, but we communicate quite a bit. She's
fantastic.
Awesome. Incredibly talented.
Yep. So Irene wanted to get some photo retouching done. She wanted to farm the work out to Fiverr to see what sort of quality was available. She picked three different mm-hmm. price points, 25 cents, $5, and $10 per image, and mm-hmm. sent the same image off to all three retouchers to see what would come back. And as you've seen from the thumbnail image, it's rather horrendous. Yep. The 25-cent version was not something you'd ever present to your client. But
I guess, and I love Irene. We do communicate quite a bit. I would actually disagree. I think she's being unfair to the 25-cent one.
Really?
Because, like, if you've ever seen that movie It with Pennywise, like, this would be a great image for Halloween. Like, and she's posting this article, like, in October. So I think, I just don't think she's giving a completely fair appraisal. Because in all fairness, if somebody, you know, had a couple images, they wanted to get some stuff ready for Halloween, didn't have a lot of time, 25 cents to create, like, a Pennywise type feel, that's a bargain. Like, I think that's a bargain. So, obviously, let's face it, you do tend to get what you pay for, right?
Yeah.
So, you know.
Yeah.
And Irene, I mean, Irene does amazing work, and she is an excellent retoucher of her own work. I think the whole retouching thing is, it's kind of like the dirty secret part of photography.
Yep.
I will get a lot of people who ask me, it's like, well, you know, what do you feel about retouching? Like, I really tight on time, but I don't know, like, does it make my work bad if I use a retoucher? And there's a couple things that happen. You know, number one, people want it for nothing. So that's where you get the 25-cent job.
Yep.
And really what they're not doing is they're not taking kind of a business approach and evaluating how much time does it take me to do it? You know, what is it going to cost me if I send it out? And then the big mistake that people make with retouchers, and I did not get to see Irene's video, so I you know, she may have talked about this, but working with a retoucher, the way I explain it to people, because I do work with a retoucher actually who's in India. So I do the total stereotype. He's a young Indian guy.
He is right.
Awesome. And he's very responsive, and he is very reasonably priced. And I don't have him do all my work start to finish. I use him for, I call it my dirty work, truly. Like, I will send him files after shoot. He's not going to do, I do all my color, you know, processing in that part. Send him files marked up. So I'm actually taking the time, going file by file, saying, listen, I need you to, you know, remove all blemishes, but I want you to clean up the edge of the hair here. I want you to remove these stray hairs here. And I've got basically, I'm sending him a PSD file from Photoshop with a layer on top that's got all the stuff marked up.
Oh, nice.
Working with a retoucher, and especially if you start to go with like high-end retouchers, they will essentially demand it. You have to realize that it's a lot like working with a makeup artist or like having an assistant. Yeah. There's a relationship that's happening. And so you can't just kind of like throw your stuff over the wall and expect it to come back amazing, because no retoucher is capable of reading your mind.
Yes.
Right? You know, their version of what looks great is not necessarily going to be your version, regardless of how talented they may be. So the challenge with working with a retoucher is realizing that you actually need to invest some time. It's kind of like if you're running a company, you got to train a new employee. If you don't train that employee, the employee will always suck.
Yeah.
The time that you're going to spend, even though it can be painful because you're overwhelmed and that's why you're hiring that new employee, that time is going to pay you dividends down the road. And that's really the key.
Definitely.
But, you know, I honestly think, you know, back in the day, we used to send our film out to get developed. So why is it like this, you have somebody else, do you retouching? Like, why is that bad? You know, the only reason why I kind of do my color portion in the front and then I do my final retouching when the file comes back is, for me, that's where I found my comfort level, because since there is a language difference and we're a world apart, I found it difficult trying to communicate the nuances.
Sure.
And since he's giving me a very reasonable price for doing work that they're actually able to do very quick, it's the perfect balance for me. It saves me the time in the tedious part.
Yep.
But that way I'm still maintaining the control over the creative portion. So for me, that's the perfect balance. Other people need a solution where they can indeed throw it over the wall. But to be able to do that, you've got to build that relationship so that there's that understanding. It's like for me when I work with a makeup artist, you know, we've kind of got this common language so that we understand, you know, how each other likes to work, what we need to be able to do things. And
That's it's really interesting, because I've always felt that with pretty much any type of service industry, and particularly where any type of creativity is involved, communication is absolutely paramount between client and service provider. I remember after my first wedding going to a picture framer, and I'd got this beautiful 16x24 print from our wedding. It was like our hero image, and saying to the guy, you know, we want to get this framed. And he says to me, what do you want done? And I said, man, I have no idea. You're the expert. Tell me what's going to work.
Right.
And
that's the worst direction you could ever give.
Really? See, to me.
Oh, absolutely.
See, to me.
Go ahead.
Okay, let me explain my thinking and why I approached it that way. Because my career path is as an audio engineer, and I've spent 30 years working in commercial radio, making radio commercials for clients. And the frustrating part from my side of the mixing console is when clients won't listen to the experience of an engineer like myself, who knows what works and what doesn't work, and they force you to work in a way that you know is not the best execution for the product or service that they are trying to advertise. And it's always been a frustration to me that clients won't listen, you know, when you're trying to say, hey, you know, we can do this and that will be a better execution. And so that was my thinking when I went to the framer and I said, mate, you are the expert. You tell me what's going to be the best way to present this image. And honestly, he came up with a way of mounting it and framing it that was way more elaborate than what I would have thought of. And I was very, my wife and I were both very happy with it. But I'm keen to hear your point of view.
I don't entirely So in terms of, let's start with your sound work. I completely agree with your philosophy when it comes to sound work, and here's why. And I don't mean this sentence in a insulting way, but so maybe it is actually from a more of a pedestrian outsider view. While I'm sure there's a certain amount of creativity to what you do, I don't see getting good sound as being as creative as taking a good photograph or framing a good photograph or putting makeup on a person's face, because they're are a lot more creative choices. Now, I realize that if you're an audiophile, you know, or maybe even like a recording artist, there are probably, you know, an infinite number of creative choices. But for the average person, something either sounds good or it sounds bad.
Sure.
So you are an expert and you're trying to make sure that, you know, the sound is going to sound the best that it can. Your framing scenario, I would suggest that you got lucky.
Right.
And here's, cause, and I'll give you the example that I see happen all the time, and it's with makeup artists, but this is why I respond to that you're the expert statement. I routinely will get messages from photographers who's like, Joe, I finally took your advice. I went online and I Googled and I found a makeup artist and I hired them. And I gotta tell you, it was the worst experience of my life. It cost me, you know, $200 for the day. And the person just looked like that retouching job that Irene had done for $5. It was horrible. Okay. Right. And 100% of the time when I speak to those people, I can ask them a couple questions and track back to how much direction did you give them? Because think about it.
Yeah.
No makeup artist is going to come in the door wanting to do a bad job. It's no different than nobody gets in front of your camera wanting to look bad.
No.
Makeup artist is going to show up, if they're getting paid especially, they're going to show up eager beaver like, hey, I want to make you happy because hopefully you'll hire me again.
Yeah.
But here's what photographers do, especially new photographers to the process. The makeup artist comes in, sets up all their stuff that looks really impressive and turns and looks eagerly at the photographer and says, okay, what are we doing? And the photographer who's scared to death because they've never worked with makeup artists before and who has no idea how to communicate with the makeup artist or what to say, instead of trying to explain what they have in their mind and actually having an idea, looks at the makeup artist and says, hey, you're the expert, do your thing. And so the makeup artist does their thing, the photographer takes the pictures, and a week later you see the photographer, the picture stuck, and the photographer says, that makeup artist was the worst damn person I've ever worked with, ever. Their work was horrible. And their work was horrible because they received no direction.
Yeah, right.
So the challenge is, as a creative person, so we'll stick with photographers for a moment.
Hmm.
You know, the simple reality of it is you have to learn to live and die by your choices, because if you're not willing to make choices, you can never progress your talent.
Sure.
You know, that piece right there means you've got to make decisions. You don't have to know all the right things to say to a makeup artist. You don't have to know how to tell them what colors to use or anything, but you've got to at least try to communicate ideas. So the same even, you know, would be with framing, in the sense that, you know, when we start talking about framing, you're talking about, you know, basically adding colors on top of an image, using accent colors in the undermats and that type of stuff. And then there's the fact of what kind of wall is it going to be mounted on? What is the decor of the room? So there's actually a lot of creative choices. Like for me, like a really good example. So I would actually do the same as you do if I were to get something framed, because I suck at home decor. Just like, that is just not my thing. You know, I watch these television shows, and of course that just makes me feel like I suck even more at home decor when I watch all these television shows we have about that here in the US. So if I, you know, when I do get frames made, and which I've done, like the framers probably hate me because I still feel the obligation to communicate. But instead of just saying, hey, you're the expert, do your thing, I literally go in with like pictures of the wall where it's going to get hung up and pictures of the room. And I will try to communicate as much information as I can in my kind of I suck at decorating language.
Yeah.
That says, this is what I like and what I don't like. Make it look good here. You know, that kind of thing.
I would imagine that most framers would appreciate that input, though.
They do. I believe me, I do. I'm routinely told, like, you know, I'd much rather have this than the hey, do your thing, because the problem with the hey, do your thing is there's that risk that, you know, their thing is not your thing.
Yeah.
So that's why I ultimately say that. And again, as a layman who, you know, I'll be the first to say, you know, in my YouTube world, audio has been my Achilles heel. It is just my nightmare portion of what I'm a photographer. Like audio, oh my God, it has been my Achilles heel. So, you know, as a layman, I look at someone like you thinking like, yeah, if you're going to tell me you should be doing it this way, that way, I'm like, okay, better, like done. Because anything that you're going to tell me is going to be a million times better than what I'm turning out at this point. So that's, you know, kind of my approach with it. But believe me, I completely understand where you're coming from, because I'm sure it is the same in your world where, you know, you will have clients just like photographers do that challenge, you know, this is what's going to work best. I have a guy who follows me on YouTube. He's one of my patrons on Patreon, and he's a West Coast cameraman for the Today Show here in the United States.
Oh, wow.
He spends a lot of time doing work with celebrities.
You
know,
right.
Setting up interviews and things like that. So he's got some great stories where, you know, him and his crew have spent, you know, like 8 hours setting up lighting in a room for what's going to be like a minute and a half interview on television. and, you know, that particular celebrity comes in and thinks they know how to do lighting. And so, of course, everything that this crew has set up, they're like, no, I want it done this way, kind of thing. And of course, it's having to deal with that balance of, obviously, this person has no clue what they're really talking about. And, you know, find that balance of, you can't say no, because if they walk out, then the interview doesn't happen.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So at the end of the day, all of it, really, whichever way you look at it, it's communication. The communication has to happen.
Definitely. The next story that Adam sent us was $6,500 given to Instagram Photography Awards winner. Can you guess what won? Obviously, the guys at F-Stoppers were not impressed with the winning image from this competition because it was a photo of a dog. And... yeah, the half just towards the end of the.
I'm scrolling through here. I just got to the page. I'm looking here.
No, so, that's okay. Just this, at the end of the second last paragraph, there's a link that says "Judge for yourself here," yep, which takes you.
Oh yeah, I've got the pictures on my screen.
Right.
So I will say this. So my personal taste, right? So these are just opinions.
Yeah.
And full disclosure, before I make my statement, I'm a dog person.
A dog person.
Yeah. I'm a dog person.
Same.
I actually think the dog picture is pretty damn cool. But if I actually had to pick my favorite image out of the whole set, and I'm not a landscape guy, I'm a people guy, I think this, the very last shot of the family in the white t-shirts and the boxes is actually really cool.
It's good.
Yeah. Articles like this, the guys at F-Stoppers are great. They're great to me. They write articles about my videos. So I hate to be contrary.
Yeah.
I really wish articles like this would just go away.
Yes.
I realize, you know, the blogs like F-Stoppers, and so I'm insulting everybody, let me get them all in. You know, F-Stoppers, Petapixel, DIY Photography. I know people from every one of these blogs. I have mad respect for them. But it's kind of like, you know, watching CNN and Fox News here in the United States. They've got to keep coming up with content.
That's
so
right.
So we write stuff about stuff that's not really helping.
As people. Long as it drives traffic, that's all that matters.
Right. It just becomes a big distraction at the end of the day. I mean, it's a contest. Contests are subjective. There's always a winner. There's always many more losers than there are winners.
Yep.
Like, so who cares? Where's the news, right? To me, there's no news.
Do you know what I find interesting about that very last image that you liked?
Uh-huh.
Is I'd love to know how they got the dog to tolerate having the cardboard thing attached to its head.
Yeah, and honestly, just looking at that, it wouldn't surprise me actually if in all five of those cases, the cardboard was added afterwards.
I was wondering that.
It wouldn't surprise me if they're actually overlays that were just photographed and added afterwards, which to me still doesn't take anything away from the shot. It simply doesn't. I there's just something about the shot I think is kind of cool.
Yeah.
And it totally looks like a shot that you would find on a stock photo website.
Yes.
Which for a lot of people, that ruins it, obviously. I understand that. You know, stock photos, you know, get a bad rap. But I think it's, you know, it's a cute shot. But yeah, to me, because you can see part of the dog's ear sticking out the side.
Yes.
So it's clearly, they're meant to be like a mask, not, I don't think it's actually a box.
Yeah.
So it literally could have been just laid in over top.
Could very well have been. And the last one, and Joe, I'll have to set this up. The reason we're going to cover this story, Yashica's unexpected Y35 camera is worse than anyone expected, is because Glenn bought one and he loves it.
No, did he really?
Yes, and he loves it. And he's actually joined the Yashica Y35 Facebook group and posted of his images amongst all these people that are bitching and moaning about how awful the camera is and how it takes crappy photos and blah, blah, blah. And as soon as Glenn posted some of his images and said, you know, I really love what this thing does, people were coming back and going, oh, thank God, somebody who knows how to take a photograph, actually using the camera the way it was meant to be used and actually getting decent results with it. But it has been really interesting to see over the last week or so how many people, particularly in that group, which I joined as well, even though I don't have the camera, are just bitching and moaning about how this camera, you know, just doesn't live up to expectations. And it's like, guys, it's not meant to replace your D4, you know?
I saw the article go by and paid very little attention to it. But now that I'm actually scrolling through this article, I have to ask a potentially stupid question. So yeah. I'm glad he's not here. What is Digifilm?
So
I've never heard of Digifilm before.
Okay,
what the heck is that?
So what it is, it's a canister shaped like a 135mm film canister.
Yeah, I'm looking at the picture of it, right.
And what it's got is a small circuit board inside it and essentially a sensor that sits right behind where the shutter is. And so essentially these are replaceable cartridges that you can take out of the body and you can put in the black and white module, or you can put in the 6x6 module, or you can put whatever modules you've bought.
Each one of these actually contains the camera sensor?
Yes. And they capture the light when the shutter is actuated, and they store it within the film canister, and you then have to take that back to your desktop or your laptop and upload the images before you can actually see what you've got, because there is no viewfinder on the camera. So you don't get to see what you shot.
How many shots do you get on a thing of digital?
I think they're 36s, like a film. It's a great concept.
I think the last time I was on your show, we might have talked about the idea of not using four-letter words in photography. I'm glad that I learned on film.
Totally. But
film is a four-letter word, and anything that even comes close to relating to film, I have no interest in. That's just weird.
Well, here's the thing.
Like, Glenn's, really weird.
Glenn's attitude is that if there is a downside to digital photography, it is that it allows people to just spray and pray, and he believes that what we all need to do is to slow down and take more time.
Oh, I do agree with that.
Yeah, and actually think about the settings before we push the shutter button. And what a project like the Y35 is trying to do is exactly that, is to make you be a little more discerning before you push the button. Now, naturally, you know, the optics are nothing like you're going to get from a Zeiss lens, and the resolution's nothing like you're going to get from a D4, but the whole point is it's slow down, think about it, you know, and really put some thought into what it is you're shooting and how you're shooting it. And for that reason, Glenn really loves it. And yeah, Instagram type photos, you know, they're not the sorts of things that you're going to necessarily print out as, you know, 50 by 150 centimeter panos or anything like that. But I thought it was interesting. I thought it was very interesting.
Wow. I'll say. Yeah, that's
not Joe's thing.
I'll be honest with you. I really wish that Kickstarter would ban all photography projects. I think it's the worst thing in the world at this point.
There has been some good things,
and not necessarily this one, because this was kind of a ground up thing. So I'll give this one a pass, even though I think the product's a little weird.
Right?
Yeah. No, I'll be honest. It just annoys the crap out of me that established companies now, you know, release a new product, so they go to Kickstarter with it just because they're getting the publicity.
It's like,
just put the damn product out and make money. why do you you know? At what point did it become a thing where companies don't give us new products unless we pay for it in advance, way in advance? When did that become a thing?
Yeah. I don't know.
So, yeah, I mean, because the whole idea with Kickstarter and all those when it started was like, you know, here's people with good ideas that don't have
but the didn't have the funding to get it off the ground. Yeah.
Right. Now we've got companies and you know, I hate to mention this one because I actually really love the company and I know the guy, but you know, guys like Spencer at MagMod, you know, these they put out great product.
Right.
But you know, they come out with these great new magnetic accessories now, but we got to go through Kickstarter. Why? They got the money.
Right.
They're selling stuff like there's no tomorrow. They got the money, build the products and sell it and make even more money.
Yeah.
Like, I don't knock them making money, but come on, why do we got to get this whole Kickstarter game? So why can't we just do business and get the products in the street?
Do you think some of those type of Kickstarter projects are using the project more as a means of real-time customer feedback rather than as a necessarily money-generating, you know, cash flow?
I would say that I think it's possible to do that, but honestly, I really think that the overwhelming majority of them are simply using it for the advertising that gets them.
Yeah, true.
You know, and obviously the cash flow is a bonus, but, you know, and I don't mean to make Magmod the poster child for this, because, again, I love their products. You know, Spencer's doing great stuff with Magmod, but, you know, they're selling Magmod products hand over fist. They don't need that money, because let's face it, even, and I get it, you know, when you're manufacturing this stuff in China and that, you've got to buy really, really large quantities. And sure, you know, in their defense, a company like Magmod, they've got to anticipate, you know, with these new modifiers they have coming out with the magnets and everything, you know, for the bigger soft boxes and that, they've got to anticipate there's going to be a very high demand. So that means they've got to have a lot of money up front to go to China, get this stuff made.
Yep.
But this company's making enough money. There's these things called banks that give short-term loans to businesses. I mean, so there's a lot of other ways they could do it. And it's not like their products are cheap.
No.
So if they were legitimately able to justify, like, well, yeah, Joe, but, you know, if we go to the bank, we have to sell it for $100 more or even $50 more, or for that matter, $25 more. Okay, then let's have a conversation.
Yeah.
But we're not hearing that as the reason for doing this. It's simply a matter, it builds hype. It does help with product awareness.
Yep.
But it's just put the product on the street and you make a ton of money. That's the whole idea. So, yeah, I think... It's, you know, it's one of those things. Kickstarter's kind of grown up, and it's not about people with great ideas anymore. It's about businesses that want to fund their next project.
Yeah.
So that's a little different.
It's a bit like eBay. It's no longer about you just wanting to get rid of the stuff that you no longer need.
Yeah, you don't want to get me started on eBay right now. I actually just finished selling my Panasonic video gear.
Oh, okay.
You know, because I do all my videos with Olympus now. I'm 100% Olympus guy. eBay's like the damn wild, wild west, and not in a good way
anymore. Yeah.
It's the last three times I've posted gear on eBay. Well, when I sold my Nikon, I had somebody almost bilk me for about $8,000 worth of Nikon gear on eBay. And fortunately, I figured out what was going on and, you know, was able to cancel the auction.
Wow.
I had two people try to get away with GH4s this time around selling off the Panasonic stuff. It's crazy. And, you know, the worst part of it is now there's so much of it happening. You can literally, like, Google, you know, different things. So what I've learned, my eBay power tip for people, anytime you sell something on eBay that's got any value to it, as soon as the sale is complete, look at a couple of things. One, look to see how much feedback does the buyer have. But then two, go and Google the buyer's mailing address. Because the problem of it is, if you ship to the address that's listed, you're supposed to be protected.
Right.
But not always. And what I've learned just by dumb happenstance is there's a pretty large database of bogus eBay addresses out there.
Oh,
if you
wow.
Google them, it pops up right away. And it's like, do not send it this address.
Yeah.
And
right.
Then when you call eBay's customer service, say, hey, they're like, oh yeah, we know about that one, but we missed it.
Right.
You know, one of my GH4s, I had them set to only ship, you know, to only sell to America. I said it would only ship in the United States because I just don't want to deal with the overseas shipping. It's expensive and it's a hassle. So, you know, the auction ran the full length of the auction, and some guy in Thailand won the auction.
Wow.
So I called their customer service and I'm like, you can look at the listing here. Because, of course, at that point, the listing, you know, you don't see the actual listing. It's like, didn't I check off that I would only sell this in the United States?
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, yes, you had that checked off. And I'm like, so then how is it you actually permit the guy to buy it? His profile says he's in Thailand.
Yeah.
So that's like simple programming. That's like really, really simple programming. Yeah, eBay, unfortunately, there's so many people trying to scam. You just have to be really, really careful.
Wow.
You know, I was kind of kicking myself because not out of any fears of not liking the Olympus, but I didn't sell the Panasonic stuff right away. I just didn't have the time.
Yep.
And what's happened now is the prices have dropped enough that I wasn't able to just sell it like by putting a post on Facebook and, you know, selling it through my followers. Because that's how I got rid of a lot of my Nikon stuff. I actually was, fortunately, the nice part about having a following is, you know, you can spread the word through your following. But eBay's rough. It's like the wild, wild west at this point. And it's a shame because, let's face it, eBay is this awesome platform.
Yeah,
but
it is.
they need to work on coming up with some better controls.
Yeah. Well, Joe, it has been an absolute pleasure to have you on the podcast again.
I appreciate it, Bruce. It's great. Tell Glenn he should go and, you know, travel more. It's all good.
Definitely. So if people want
to... I'm going to see him next week. So I finally actually get to meet the man in the flesh next week at Photo Plus in New York. So
fantastic.
I'm very much looking forward to it.
I will warn you now, you will be traumatized forever afterwards.
I'm pretty much anticipating that. So yes, I'm going to go into it, looking over my shoulder and being ready for anything. But yeah, I'm looking forward to
Excellent.
It.
Excellent. So. If anyone wants to check out Joe's stuff, definitely check out his YouTube channel at /PhotoJoeEdelman, all one word. On Facebook, he is The Joe Edelman. On Instagram, he is Joe Edelman. And on Twitter, he is at Joe Edelman. Surprise, surprise. So, mate, it has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you once again. And we will definitely have to do this again.
Awesome, Bruce. I really appreciate it. It's always fun.
Thanks,
Take
mate.
Take care.
Talk soon.
Bye now.
ShutterZinkPodcast.com.
Another audio2.com quality podcast.
For questions, comments, and feedback, email theboys@ShutterZinkPodcast.com.